Sack jigger would jig the sacks, and they would sew the tops of sacks with an ear on each side, and then they would let them down a little trace or a little slide and the ground. And there were four people on those combines.
And these crews, where did they come from?
Well, it was when I was around, it was Dad and the neighbors. And, of course, I was a young kid. Before that, of course, and the old timers could certainly tell you, Glenn McKenzie, certainly they had threshing crew that came around. Mm-hmm. I can remember the very last of the threshing crews, but I wasn't involved with them. And that took many more men.
Your folks had hired men that lived there with them.
Yes. Basically, that was through haying season. And they would have...
they were itinerant?
Yes. Mm-hmm. They basically came from the Dust Bowl areas, mm-hmm. from Oklahoma and... four young brothers that were all single that came out in a roadster, and they lived, a couple of them lived, slept in the haymow of the barn down at the folks', and I think one or two of them slept, in the car, and one of them slept upstairs in my folks' house. And then Dad basically always had a hired man. Of course, Dad had a lot more ground then, too.
Where would a hired man typically come from?
Well, usually it was, they were kids. It was right out of high school. Dad didn't have a job. Many of them didn't have much of an education. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks came. I mean, this was the end of Grapes of Wrath.
Yes.
Tobacco Road came from the Dust Bowl area.
Yes.
I know the Davis boys came out from, or Miller, excuse me. There was a Davis and there was a Miller. The Miller boys came out from Oklahoma. I can remember some of the stories they told about the dirt and what they had or what they had that blew away.
Would most of those hired men move on gradually, or did some of them settle around here?
A little bit of both. There's a fella, and this guy, I think, that I haven't talked with him in about 3 years, but he was very sharp. Doc Miller lives in Union, and he was one of the boys, and he remembered Dad, and really liked my dad, and I kind of think Doc worked at the mill, although I'm not 100% certain. And then there's a young fella that I also liked really well that worked at the mill at Elgin. I'm not sure whether he went. I think he went in the service. He went in the war too, and then when he came back from war too.
Well, while they were
Clarence Hayes,
while they were working around the farm, were they essentially separate from families, or would they?
They ate their
take
meals.
Take part in some family life.
They ate their meals basically in the house. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't remember them being socially in that day and age. Farmers played pinochle. Couples played pinochle, and later canasta came on.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they weren't involved in that. I suppose maybe they went to town and got drunk on Saturday night. I don't know.
Well, I guess one of the things I was thinking was, do you think they were considered essentially lower class?
Oh, I didn't feel them that way. Of course, I'm just a young kid.
Yes, but you get a sense of those things.
No, I didn't feel it that way. No, and...
did you talk to them? Or
oh, yes.
Did
oh,
they
yeah.
tell you stories?
Yeah, and they were all very nice. I never had one that I felt uneasy around or felt... I mean, good grief, the world we have today. You wouldn't want to put your kids alone around, you know?
They did go into town on Saturdays to have a good time?
Well, Saturday nights,
yes.
Yeah.
They had to work during the day on Saturday. Yeah. 6 days a week or 7 days a week work?
Well, sometimes at harvest they work 7 days
a
week.
I think, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they worked 12-hour days, and you took care of the horses first.
Mm-hmm.
And you got them ready, you watered them, and you harnessed them. And
they probably bathed in the watering trough.
Yes. Was your mother cooking for them?
Yes. Yes.
Do you remember some of the kinds of food she served?
Oh, well, yes. Basically, it was a meat and potatoes type of thing, a lot of chicken. And, of course, on the farm, you got your eggs, meat, and milk.
Yeah.
And Mother raised a big garden.
Big meal at noon on three harvest times?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Started, what, about 6
a.m.?
6:30. noon, and, about 12, yeah, or 12 and, or 12:30 from, and, did you call that dinner or lunch?
I think we called it dinner, and then we called supper supper.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that's right. That's what I remember, too.
In fact, I can remember calling when I got cultured. You know, let's go out for supper, and people look at you strangely. Where's this kid from?
It meant something different.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
By the way, I was reading the other day, Lewis and Clark's men, I had to have about 8.5 pounds of food a day when they were pulling up the Missouri, mm-hmm, going across the Bitterroots.
Sure.
And a lot of that was lard and bear grease. I'm trying to formulate a talk on Lewis and Clark, but I'm not getting very far.
This is the year to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
When you finished a day's work and the sacks were filled with wheat, they'd be brought back to a barn to be
they'd be loaded into a header box or into a wagon for a year or two is all I can remember, and then they had the little trucks and they would be taken to La Salle, which is where the grain elevator was,
mm-hmm,
and then of course it was just very shortly after that and they did away with horses and mm-hmm,
what was the trucks. Selling buying procedure for the year's harvest?
Good grief, don't ask me. I don't recall.
Oh, well, later you must have been involved in doing that, though.
Oh, well, yes. Yeah, later. In fact,
if they took a load into La Salle, would they sell it for the going price was?
No, you sold your crop at the end of the harvest.
Yes, but was there any effort to sell at the highest possible price, or did you simply sell when it was harvested?
Generally speaking, rule of thumb, and I think most farmers would agree with this, and I didn't agree with it this year, and I really lost some money, is within six weeks after harvest is your best price. Now, I really do not know why. And I recall this, it's kind of humorous. I remember I had an uncle that Kittle Brothers was head of the big building they tore down.
K-I-D-D-L-E.
Yeah, K-I, Mert and Fred Kittle. And then there was a Lyle Kittle, I think, over at Himmler too, but Kittle Brothers. In fact, Fred was a state legislator one time, but anyway, the newspaper, the Observer, was coming out daily with the price of wheat. And Kittle's, right after harvest, was 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 cents a bushel under what the price was in the newspaper. And I know my uncle went into Island City and said to Mert Kittle, he says, well, the paper quotes it as, say, $1.67, and you're offering $1.65. And he says, you know what, I want to know why. Mark Kittle says, well, sell it the newspaper then. Go sell it the newspaper.
The Kittles were shrewd about their purchase price and their sale price.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And I think I've heard that a good deal of the grain that was raised in Union County, at least in earlier years, went from the Kittles to Portland and then into ships and over to Japan and other countries.
Likely did. They had flour milling, mm-hmm, also.
Mm-hmm.
And at one time, probably many people have told you that, it was run the paddle wheel by water power.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I can just barely remember that.
What specific types of wheat were you raising most successfully here?
White Club.
White Club?
There was some Red Club. It was all club wheat. It wasn't the bearded wheat, mm, varieties.
Was this something your father had discovered as to
Well, he didn't discover it. I mean,
discovered the brand, but discovered that it grew well here or that it would sell well.
Yes. It was also what they called La Salle Club, and it was a white club, and I'm not sure just why it was called La Salle Club. There was a spring wheat, and boy, I've forgotten.
think these were hybrid varieties?
Darned if I know. They were club wheat.
Well, I'm asking this because...
It was soft white. Soft white wheat.
The growing conditions in the Grand Ronde Valley for wheat and several other crops are in many respects different, are they not, from other places in the Northwest?
Yes. Yeah, I know hard red winter is coming in more and more. And then, I wish my brain was a little better. There was also, they had a turkey red or something red that was a hard wheat. But I don't think they were raised very much in volume. Basically club, white club.
Let me ask.
I can't answer.
Okay, let me ask parenthetically. Considering what you learned about farming from your father and perhaps from other farmers in the area, did you consider yourself to be a scientific farmer?
No, not really.
Was it seat of your pants kind of farming?
No, probably as much. I learned basically what I learned from my dad.
Mm-hmm.
I was not big in going. I think I was pretty quick to follow with fertilizers and sprays, but I wasn't in the vanguard.
Where were you getting most of your information about what you should do?
From the county agent.
Huh. Well, tell me about how you and the county agent would interact about these things. Was it face-to-face, face-to-face or through publications?
Publications, basically.
Mm-hmm. Over at the Union Ag Station?
No, Island City.
Island City,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Would you confer with the agent about what next year's crop should be each year?
Not usually. We had cattle, and basically we had alfalfa and wheat, a little bit of barley.
Mm-hmm.
And you would keep a field in alfalfa until the alfalfa fizzled out, the gophers started coming in, a lot of cheatgrass came in, and then you would start rotating wheat, and then we started renting some other grounds, so we had pasture hay, and just usually enough oats or barley to feed your horses, and of course horses were being phased out.
Mm-hmm. What did you do with the hay?
Fed through the winter with the cattle.
You didn't ship any out?
No. We got up to about 120, 125 registered Hereford cattle, horned Hereford.
Mm.
And we sold bulls and occasionally heifers. And then as the last 15 years, as the market has gone into other breeds and got out of the English breeds, particularly the Herefords, the horned Herefords, I have one, I think, that I believe, two or three horned Hereford cattle in Union County. I like the horned animals, but basically most people do not.
Mm-hmm.
Because they think they're more trouble to take care of, and if you're feeding close in feeders, they can do more damage. But I like the Hereford breed because they're docile or gentle. You go out to look calving, which happens between the end of February and the end of April. You go out and check your cattle in the middle of the night or something. Some of these new breeds of cattle, you got to spend as much time looking behind you and worry about what's going to hit you. And some of these new breeds is like trying to drive China pheasants down a road. The Hereford and Angus is not that way. Particularly the Hereford. The Angus is a little more skittish.
Aside from selling some of the bulls for breeding purposes, do you still sell to packing houses?
No, race cattle, calves are born in March, and you keep about top 30 of your heifers for breeding, regenerating your herd, and then I sell the spring calves in the end of November, usually about tax time, to pay property taxes. And anymore, I'm not really selling bulls because basically people are wanting the other breeds, they're wanting the Gelbiths and Salars.
When you sell the calves, what is that for?
To the livestock yards.
Is it, but about people four. Want to start their own herds? Is
no, no. Basically, they go to feedlots. Okay. You've got, this is one of the largest feedlots in the Northwest. Oh. Not feedlots, auction yards.
Hmm.
I think the one at Madras may be larger.
Hmm.
But They have buyers come in every Thursday, and they're shipped out, and you keep about, I keep about a top 20 to 30%, 35% of the heifers, depending on the year, and I sell the other 67%, and I castrate the bull calves.
Well, are the calves that you sell taken off to feedlots to fatten up and then go to packing
yes,
houses?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Of course, the cows, after they're 10 or 12, 14 years old, are canner cutters that you also sell at the sale yard.
They're what?
Canner cutter.
Canner cutters?
Canner cutter. In other words, they're used for beef broth and for beef.
I hadn't heard that expression.
Canned meat.
Canner cutter. Mm-hmm. You've never heard that term.
No, I have not. I'm not a farm boy.
Glenn McKenzie could tell you, or Clayton
probably
Fox.
Go into, you know, chili and all the canned things.
Not the prime sirloin tip cut.
No.
Hamburger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're the hamburger. Okay. Yeah, they're the hamburger animals.
This may be a little bit of a digression here, but the auction yard in, you said, Island City.
Well, it's on McAllister Night.
Yeah, right. How long has that been there?
Boy, it's been there since I can recall.
Tell me about some of the history of that.
I don't really. It's had different ownerships. I really don't.
Was it placed there because it was close to the railroad?
I would assume so. when I was very young, I know there was a stockyard in La Grande, right there at the on the west side of Y.
I'm thinking of the mill.
Sorry. West side of Y, close to Riveria School. Are you familiar with where the old swimming pool was?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The Crystal Bund.
Right over from the Crystal. It's really, well, I can tell you exactly where it is. It's, what is that street? Yeah, it is Y. Where it goes a block west of 2nd Street and then makes the elbow turn. And if you know, there's a railroad spur, a dead end spur that goes. That was where the old stockyard was.
Nice.
And there was a stockyard at Imbler. I suspect there was one at Union and Elgin, but I do not know that. I don't know whether you want to know interesting stories or not.
Well, certainly.
This wasn't when I was alive, although probably when I may have been a baby, but Dad, and I do remember the stockyards at Imbler. Very vaguely, though, but there were three brothers. They were called the Traverso brothers, and they were Italian.
T-R-A-V-E-R-S-O?
T-R-A-V-E-R-S-O, mm-hmm. Yeah, Traverso. And then they had a sidekick, and four of them. And I want to tell you, they lived right under the base of Mount Harris, between Harris and Fanny. I'm not sure whether they were Italian or Sicilian. I kind of think they might have been Sicilian. But who was the actor, John, that had the gravel voice? It was often in all the gangster movies. But anyway.
Edward G. Robinson.
Thank you. That was it. Yes, yes. Johnny Traverso's Edward G. Robinson. And the others, they looked like the Earps. And when they rode, I mean, there was no guessing around about it. Those guys were cowboys. As far as I know, I don't know that they ever had a mean bone in their body. One of them's name was Till, T-I-L-L, and Johnny, and Verge. And then they had the sidekick, and he wore a sheepskin, all heavy. What was that Madame Dorian wore? The thing that
shawl.
Well, yeah, it's a shawl, but it's a big. It's a word for it. Anyway, but they would drive their cattle from between Fanny and about halfway between Fanny and Harris. They'd drive it over the stockyards of Denver. And Dad felt very sorry for him. In fact, Dad sold him the place when they had come into this valley. I think probably 1921, 2, 3, 4, during that time. It might even be in here. In fact, Vicki might even have this in here. But she said that the school kids at Imbler would hide in the corners of the chutes and in the corners of the corrals. And when the Traversal brothers would come in with their animals, of course they had several hundred head, they would get up and yell and scream and ring bells, and the cattle and the stuff would go in every direction. And of course they were a minority, definitely a minority, and they were really, I mean, they looked like 5 miles of bad road. I mean, you wouldn't want to meet those guys at a Christmas social, but I think they were very nice guys. But Dad said he felt so sorry for them because they would come all the way across the valley, over to Imler at least, from across the valley, and the kids just gave them hell.
And they came over there only to sell their cattle?
To put them in stock, yeah, to put them on freight cars. I assume to go to Swift or one of those other packing companies in Portland. And I'm not sure whether they had a sale yard here then or not. Because everything initially was shipped in cattle cars. Basically, the World War II.
Well, were they shipping these animals without having any sort of guarantee about whether
they
would be taken or what the price would be?
I do not know.
It sounds like speculation.
I do not know. I really cannot tell you. I know Vicki in this has an instance of when the Depression hit, and Dad had a load of pigs that he sent to Swift in Portland.
Mm-hmm. And then he never got paid.
He never got paid. Yeah. He never got the hogs back.
Well, I think I was probably thinking of that one. I wonder if that was a common occurrence.
I'm sure it probably was, but I can't tell you. Mm. I really, darn few guys, a Glenn McKenzie or a Clayton Fox can tell you that. But
you
I
think
can't.
It might be true to say that in the 20s, 30s, maybe 40s, people who raised cattle around here weren't necessarily making much money?
Well, they weren't making much money, no. What the farmer had, the people in town during the Depression didn't have, is they could raise their own vegetables and they had their milk, meat,
sure.
and eggs.
Sure.
And they could subsist. People in town didn't have that, but when I started school, I was one of, I think there was one other, I think I may have been the only kid that the folks drove to school in an automobile. The rest rode horses or bicycles.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, I went to Denver because they had the only buses for 3 years. And when I went to La Grande, starting in the sixth grade, I wanted to go out for sports. But it was right toward the end of War II, and there was gas rationing and rubber rationing, and you know, the stamps that came along with it. And if I didn't catch the bus home, I was in big trouble. And there was no way I could go out, not that I might have been any good anyway, but there was no way I could go out for football or basketball or any other sport. And I didn't resent it, but I always felt kind of bad that I was never had the opportunity. And that's maybe what caused me to go more into music and other things.
Also requires after school time, though.
Well, yes, it did. I took sectional and regional and public speaking in FFA, and went to state and took second. And also, I and two other guys, and they both live around here yet, took first at Pacific International in livestock judging my junior year of high school in Portland. And I've got the banner right over there. But other than that, it was the only thing I did.
You keep saying things that I want to ask you about. How did you learn to judge livestock?
I took ag class.
High school?
High school in all 4 years.
Uh-huh.
Under a very fine instructor called Ray Wendell. And
part of his curriculum was to teach judging of livestock?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We judged dairy cattle and beat the kids that came out of Tillamook and the Western Valley, Willamette Valley, that had lots of dairy animals,
mm-hmm.
but, which I always thought was kind of unique. At least our instructor thought it was pretty good.
What makes Union County, or the parts of it that you've known, a good place to raise cattle?
we have a pretty good rainfall in spite of the last couple of years, and I mentioned this in Oregon Trail Talks, and I think it's still true to a degree today. John C. Fremont said, you know, the lush bunch grass throughout this valley, we don't really have that much BLM ground, and until you get out of this valley, in the Baker Valley and other areas, we don't really have sagebrush. And we have basically been able to keep this valley, I'm talking about the mountains now, pretty free of any noxious weeds. We're having some problems now. But we've got a good aquifer in the valley, and we've got deep, dark, tillable soil. In fact, Fremont said it was, made the pioneers the finest they've seen since they left Missouri. I really don't know. We do get a lot of wind here, and that's why I have the apple trees up here, protection from the wind.
Have the herds been relatively free of disease or other sickness?
Yes.
Why do you think that is? Are they somewhat isolated?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They've had very little red water, which is urinary tract, red urine. I think about all most farmers vaccinate for is Bang, the brucellosis, mm-hmm. Bang's disease.
Have you availed yourself of the services of veterinarians very much?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
What have they done for you?
Anything I can't do for myself.
I should think, though, if you've been around cattle all your life, quite a few veterinary jobs you would have learned to do yourself.
Oh, yeah, I pull every calf I can. Mm-hmm. About 6 weeks ago, the day before yesterday, I had my gallbladder out, and believe it or not, I really hated to. But I had a calf coming. He was coming correctly. By correctly, that front feet are down like this. When they're like this, they're backwards. Or if their tail's out, they're breech. But I could see one ear, but his head, his nose was sideways, and she had quit straining, her water had broken, and four or five hours went by. Oh, I hated to, because I had $158, I think, and that's almost half the worth of the calf when you sell it in November. But and I got the cow in, and I roped her, and I put her in up here, tied her up, but she was, of course, in pain, a labor pain, and she was stepping around quite a bit, and it was, what, a weekend after I got home, 4 or 5 days after mm-hmm. I got home from the hospital, and they didn't do a laparoscopy, they had to cut me, because I had some gangrenous infection, and I thought all she needs to do is bump me or kick me and break that open, so I had two vets come out here, and it was $158, which I dearly hate to do, again, the conservative flair coming out of it. But that's the only one I've had to take care of this year. Son-in-law comes over when we get ready to wear, and my daughter, the older daughter, the one that wrote this, comes over when we get our calving season over, and they spend part of the day, and we take care of all the calves. I have foreign cattle, so anything I'm going to sell, I put a acid on their nubbins of a horn, which you just feel like a little button at that time. And of course we castrate and we give blackleg shot, blackleg septicemia. Well, actually it's an 8-way deal for 8 different diseases. I can't even tell you what the other 5 or 6 are. And then we turn them out into, I've got 4 or 5 pastures.
All these things you do for yourself, you don't need a veterinarian for them.
No.
What services do our veterinarians usually needed for then?
Well, just pulling a calf, or if you have a cow that
goes down,
or
what does that mean?
Well, gets down or gets weak.
Sometimes their calf lays against a nerve or something, and after the calf is born, they can't get up.
Oh.
Or they get like if you have a really wet spring,
mm-hmm.
And they get they're used to hay, and they get a lot of green grass. They get a weakness. What is it you call that? Anyway, the vet comes out and
grass tetany.
Yeah.
It's a tetanus.
Gives them a like an IV.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose it's vitamins and minerals.
Yes.
To try to give that cow strength to get up. Even though they're huge animals, when they go down, they sometimes just give up.
Then what?
Then they die.
You shoot them. What do you do with the carcass?
Well, there used to be a rendering service in Baker City, but that's gone now. And basically what you do is you have to drag them out to a ravine and dispose of them.
Some of the coyotes and other animals around here help with that?
Oh, yeah.
This is April 5th.
Fourth.
Yes. again, at the Webster's place in the Grand Ronde Valley.
Well, I might mention first about the cattle. Dad purchased, I think, 5 head of horned Herefords, registered horned Herefords in 1934, or possibly 1935. It was the year I was born, and they were basically pretty good quality seed stock Herefords at that time. And I think the next year he purchased 4 more, and he built up a herd of about 125 head.
Where would he have to go to purchase cattle like that?
He purchased them here in the valley. He purchased them from one of the Conrads, and they had, I think, initially bought them in Idaho. I'm not that well versed on exactly. At that time, Hereford was the premier, by far the dominant breed of cattle, horned Hereford, not polled Hereford. Although Dad didn't participate in what they call pompered bull sales, in other words, the bulls that where you currycombed their tail and their in the back, and you washed them, and you cleaned their hooves off, and the halter broke them, and all of that stuff, or
did you say pampered or pampered?
Well, pampered or paw, yeah, same difference. Probably a Websterism. It's pampered, pampered. Yes,
I had not heard of pampered bulls before. I understand what you mean.
Yeah, he basically sold bulls for less because he didn't have to put the time in to, as you would another...
Called them range bulls.
Yeah, they called them range bulls. Dad and individuals that bought from Dad always made the comment, this is a cattleman's comment, but Webster, your bulls will go to the top of the mountain. That meant that a bull on rangeland, a bull would usually service 20 cows. On farm pasture land, in other words, land like this, flat land, they'd service about 30 cows. But individuals who were in the stock raising business, or many individuals who are in the stock raising business, and I'm not trying to overemphasize this, because there's a lot that wouldn't buy Dad's bulls on a bet, because they didn't look in the top quality condition. But they would go to the top of the mountain. In other words, when you turned them out, they'd like to go up the side of Mount Emily or the side of the west side of the Grand, well, any place. You weren't going to have to worry about them getting lame, usually, or many times a pampered or pampered bull. If you turn them out, they're so used to good grain, oats, and good quality alfalfa and so forth, that they'll just lay down by a pond or a creek and never go out and breed a cow or breed fewer cows. They're lazy. They're lazy. Mm-hmm. In a word, they're lazy. Mm-hmm. And but when you buy these show animals, and this, I think, really goes for more than bulls. I think it goes for many types of animals. I mean, and they're lovely to look at, but do they do the job for you? And I know many buyers, particularly in my younger years, would come back to Dad time after time. And then there were always what they call gypo buyers. I don't know whether you're familiar with that term or not.
I've heard of gypo loggers.
Okay, same. I can't speak much about gypo loggers. But there were individuals that would, I don't want to use the word roam, they would circuit the valley, and probably a half a dozen valleys, Baker, Wallow, and Grant County in particular, those four valleys. And they were pretty adept at, they would trade, or they would buy a bull, or they would, and then they would take it over maybe 17 miles or up to Cricket Flat or up to Enterprise, and they would know where they were going to place the bull when they bought it from you or from Dad. And they made their living simply by trading, by horse trading. It wasn't horses, but they did it by trading animals. And where Dad would, I can remember the earlier bulls that you sold for $125 to maybe $250. That was and more too, and maybe up until the early 50s. And then of course they got up to $400 or $500, and then when I kind of quit selling bulls, they were bringing $800 to $1,100. But then other breeds of cattle, I'm talking about beef cattle, not dairy cattle, came into demand, and the hybrid cross with a Hereford. The Hereford is primarily known as a milk producer for the calves, not for milk, but not milk for dairy purposes, yeah. Mm-hmm. But for raising the calf. But there's also what they call hybrid vigor. In other words, if you cross a Hereford cow with an Angus bull or Charolais or any other type of bulls, and we're finding this out here. I just changed over to have a black Angus bull 2 years ago, and it was one of the toughest things I ever had to do because I was so proud of the Herefords. But a hybrid bull, just like hybrid corn or hybrid wheat or hybrid vegetable garden or rose bushes, will raise a product that has more vigor, a little faster growth, and that type of thing. So the Hereford bull market is pretty non-existent now. People don't like cattle raisers, I shouldn't say breeders, individuals that have stock generally don't care as much for the horned Herefords, because you put a horned Hereford in a feedlot and they can hurt each other, and they can also they get their horns caught in the stanchions and that type of thing. Dad always liked the horned Hereford, and I liked the horned Herefords because we thought they were the most docile, and they were also the best brand we had. I would say this is probably an exaggeration, but we have the one pasture just west of LeGrand, and anymore, now your age, my age, most, or certainly my parents' age, most of that generation was born and spent some time on farms and ranches. They knew what agriculture was, they knew what animals were. But 80% of the people today haven't a clue they have a clue, but not realistically, on farm animals. And our pasture up Dio Canyon was just close enough to LeGrand that if a tree went across the fence or somebody left a gate open, cattle were right down to where the hospital is now, or central school, and inevitably, right when we were the busiest in the summertime, he'd get a call from some frantic housewife, and because the Herefords had horns, they thought they were bulls. And oh my goodness, I've got 32 great big bulls out eating my shrubs. Well, obviously nobody has 32 bulls, and all they'd have to do is inspect them a little bit, and they didn't know they were cows, but the average individual today thinks anything with horns is mean. That's not true at all. A Hereford is the most docile breed of animal. I may be a little prejudiced, but far more docile than many of the other breeds. Many of the other breeds, kind of like driving China pheasants down a road, where a Hereford, and if I have a wild, an animal that's a little spooky or a little bad in handling, I simply won't keep them. They're sold for can of gutter.
You were going to talk about the cattle drive.
Cattle drive, yeah.
I was going to ask about that. Please, yeah. Go.
At that time, Dad didn't have as many cattle as he had, but he still had 50 or 60 head of cows. And they lived, my folks lived 11 miles from LeGrand, and like I say, I was an only child. And sometime, usually early in May, we would load the baby calves, which were March and April calves, into the back of a stock truck, a cattle truck, and Mother would drive ahead of the cows with the cattle truck, and with the calves bawling and the cows mooing, following on behind, there was only Dad and I and occasionally a neighbor, Lauren Tucker, and we would, on three saddle horses, drive the cattle. I know you don't quite know where my daughter lives, but we would drive. Everybody had fences. Everyone had fences. There were no farms without fences. That came when grass came into the valley in the late, started in the late 40s, and now hardly anyone has fences. I am very much in minority on the land I have in having fences. But they would start up what's is Webster Road, and they would go to McDonald and all gravel road. And then they would go McDonald to Holly, and Holly to Buchanan, and hit Hunter Road, the paved road, at where the Moss Chapel School was, about 2 miles north of Island City. And we would, with Mother leading, and the calves bawling, and the cows mooing and trying to catch up with the truck, in a kind of a slow, gentle procession. We would take those cattle, 50 or 60, we would go over the bridge at Island City, over the railroad track, and of course the Grand Round River, straight through the intersection at Island City, where the light is, south on McAllister, past the golf course, all of those new homes, most of which weren't there at that time, certainly the developments weren't there, and we would turn. I think you saw an article, was it yesterday or day before, of the Blue Mountain Grange, right where that Blue Mountain Grange is. We would turn right on Geckler, which is gravel, and we would go on Geckler. There was no freeway, and we would go over the UP railroad tracks and over Highway 30, which went to Union and North Powder, up Highway 30 to C Street. Again, up Geckler to C Street. Again, Grand Round Residence wasn't there. The state buildings weren't there. The forestry. Up C Street and turn on Sunset. Go up Sunset, past where the Grand Round Hospital is. Majority of those homes weren't there. So there were some old homes, obviously, on C Street, because that was Old Town LeGrand. And we would and go up the mountain at Dio Canyon, which is KRL. But K. And we would do that in a day. And we never got in trouble. Everybody.
Did you have to have a permit or approval?
No.
Did anybody know you were doing this beforehand?
No. Never. And we weren't the only ones that did it.
Mm-hmm.
We were the only ones that did it from out here. But Smoots Brothers, several of them, Hughes's, several of them did it from out Ladd Canyon Road and Foothill Road and came and went up C Street. And then the pastures would be up by Morgan Lake, all that area from Morgan Lake to Starkey, Rock Creek.
Was that land that your father owned?
Yes. 431 acres.
When did he purchase it approximately?
Yeah, 1934. Mm-hmm. When he got the first 5 cows. So that, I think that is in here. That was original Van Blocklin land.
Was all of it fenced?
Yes. Yeah, yes. Barbed wire was probably 100 years old then, and some of it still is.
All these cows branded?
Yes.
So
yes.
That you could identify.
And they're also
them.
Yes, and they're also horn branded. I could have shown you that yesterday or the day before. Registered cattle. Obviously, you had to basically know. And then we accumulated a second pasture, and then a third, and then a fourth. I think this being the fourth, third or fourth here. And so we started trucking when I was instead of taking them by trailing them, when I was a junior in college, which had been 1955. And we started trailing them because there started being complaints about cattle. They weren't our cattle. You're no sense telling whose they were, but we could take those cattle. They would follow the truck. And like I say, people on, imagine this, people on C Street all had picket fences. They had manicured yards, and they had shrubs and flowers. But over on Sunset, basically all those homes weren't there. There were a few of the central school wasn't there. Certainly the hospital wasn't there. The medical clinics.
Old dairy.
Yeah, yes. Miller's Dairy was up there. But then we'd turn up, and we did that in a day. Mm-hmm. Now, you think of trying to go through Island City today. You think of trying to go up C Street. Yeah.
While they were there during the summer, I suppose until September, October?
Yeah.
Did you have to go up there to check on them periodically?
Oh, yes. And we basically reserved Sundays to salt them and to check on them. And
otherwise, they were perfectly independent?
Yes.
Plenty to eat.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. And then we would bring them out. Before we started trucking them up, we did build a corral up there with kind of a loading chute. It all burned up in the fire that went through in La Grande in 1973. But we would truck them home. Simply because I really don't know why. I guess that time of year, the more likelihood of snow and bad weather, and we left them till the middle of November in the truck.
Do you have any idea how much weight they gained while they were there?
No, I don't have it. They were in better shape when they came out. Bunch grass, there's no substitute for bunch grass. That's a natural grass. It wasn't planted or a hybrid variety of grass. It was the old original grass that the homesteaders.
What is there about bunch grass that's more nutritious?
You know, I really don't know. I can't. I can't tell you that. But and of course you can't overgraze. And much of what has happened and much of the environmental movement. In retrospect, I see their points because many ranchers overgrazed. They certainly did it with sheep. In this BLM land, and the fact that much land went into sagebrush and the poor quality that they have now is because of overgrazing, but a good steward didn't do that.
When you were fairly young, was there bunch grass in other parts of the valley?
Not on the valley floor, I don't think.
There had been, hadn't there?
Oh, originally, the 30 by 15 miles.
Was it essentially tilled for farmland, so it was gone?
Yes, basically. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the things I talk about in my Oregon Trail speech, the Indians, this is where Burnt River Canyon got its name, in the September of the year when it set fire to the... to the grasses, and as the pioneers were coming through from Farewell Bend up to Baker Valley, what's now called Baker Valley, they crossed Burnt River Canyon over 20 times, and they would have to, and I wear a heavy kerchief, and they would have to wet that in the water because the ashes and the soot from the Indians setting fire to the bunch grass, and of course cheatgrass, and even though this valley was a sea of purple from the camas, it was basically all bunch grass. There was a lot of rose bushes out here too.
Burning it, I suppose, had the effect of making it
regenerate
the next year.
Regenerating.
Yes.
It's the same thing that the farmers do now with the 80-acre field. I started out on Bonneville. I was going to mention Bonneville. When Captain Bonneville came through in 1834, they were coming back from Astor, from John Jacob Astor's Port Astoria. They saw this darkening black sky and atmosphere when they were clear over west of the Pendleton area. And he had a group of trappers or so forth with him. They were going back east to the States. And they took several days. They finally got to the rim of the valley up in what we think, and John Evans has kind of corroborated this as near as you can, was our pasture, because they said there was a spring overlooking the valley on the southwest corner, or close to the southwest corner of the valley. But anyway, when they got to the rim of the valley looking down, well, looking out on this valley, of course, no Legrand, no anything, no pine, it was 1834. It was 27 years before the first pioneers settled here in 1861. He wrote that the valley was a vast conflagration. It was entirely on fire, and it billowed up in great flames. It came from the Indians setting fire and then to regenerate the grass for the next spring. And they camped supposedly for a few days, according to Bonneville's journals. You're probably familiar that Washington Irving wrote quite a bit about Bonneville and probably amplified everything Bonneville said, but they were not able to get down into the valley at all. They had to totally skirt the valley and go on back of the valley, kind of towards Starkey, and came out where Starkey is now, and came out in the Baker Valley, because it said it was a sea of fire that totally blackened the sky and the atmosphere.
Is it true that some of that burning was to clear out below the ponderosa pines in order to protect them?
I don't know about that. I think it was just to regenerate the grass. I kind of contradict myself to a degree, and nobody's really caught me on it yet, but I'm not really certain. Because they say the Indians also, besides the camas, they picked rose hips, or the rose bushes, and they took the sarvis berries, and of course the rose hips are used for medicinal purposes, and they got those in the valley. Well, if they set fire to the valley every single year, you're not going to have rose hips. My guess is maybe the rose hips they got around the edge of the valley. And how you would stop a fire in the late fall of the year, this was in September.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine stopping a fire. I can sure imagine starting it, but good grief almighty, I mean, if there was nothing but dry bunch grass, I don't know how they stopped it. Well, obviously I don't think they did stop it, but I don't have an explanation for that. Nobody's ever pushed me on that.
Mm-hmm. I thought I read somewhere that perhaps the Indians had some kind of intuitive sense of if the ecological balance, that if the trees were to be preserved, there had to be clearing out underneath them to prevent worse fires.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I'm sure that's probably true. I'm sure that's probably true.
There were many more trees in the valley at one time.
Yeah.
Are we pretty sure of that?
I certainly assume there were. I can't say for certainty. I've never really asked that particular question. I can't say.
Do you know of any logging that's ever occurred on near the valley floor?
Well, they logged right to the edge of the mountains, but no, I don't.
I know that there were a couple of sawmills near Somerville, for example.
There were numerous.
I suppose they would have liked to get their logs from as close by as possible.
There were numerous sawmills, many portable mills, and the original settlers generally that had farms in the valley would buy 10 or 20 or 40 acres of timberland right at the edge of the valley, and these small acreage tracts In fact, there was a lawsuit fought about 6 or 8 or 10 years ago. I'm not sure it went through a lawsuit, but they certainly took them long enough to get the thing settled. There's a little road right up here as you make this last elbow turn, and there were probably 9 or 10 or 12 landowners that had little tracts of 10 or 20 or 40 acres of timber, and the reason they had that timber, it certainly didn't, it wasn't for livestock because it's too thick. It was for firewood to heat their homes, and Dad had 20 acres, I think, right over here about 3/4 mile, and the road, which was never a declared road, took off, and I can name 8 or 10 or 12 old name, pioneer name landowners that had little chunks of land over there, and there was a doctor right up here in the corner. They're since gone, Stevens, Brad Stevens and his wife. It's this log home up here as you make the turn. Now the number two person in Grand Round Hospital, Paul Shorb and his wife own it, but they closed. They actually, the lands all came below where the road went north, and they closed the gates. What happened? I don't know how much of this you want to hear. Darn it. People from town started dumping garbage.
Oh, yes.
They would come out and they would dump garbage. Well, obviously, the person that had the, it was Dr. Stevens and his wife, padlocked the gate. Well, they put up a Powder River gate and they padlocked it and they gave everybody a key. Well, that's only good until you get some Johnny Sixpack that decides to jimmy up the lock, put a matchstick in it, or a 22 bullet in it, or some super glue in it. And so, and there's always one of those around, and that's one of the problems we had before some landowners started building homes up the Oak Canyon. If you padlock your gate, I know I'm digressing here, and shows I'm getting old and senile. If you padlock your gate, there's somebody that, you know, I've hunted up here for 100 years and nobody's going to stop me. And they're going to go through, and we're out here. You can't camp up there. You can't patrol a place. And somebody with a winch on a four-wheel drive with a couple of beers and hunting season, or sometimes just for honoring us, they'll take out the gate and maybe an eighth of a mile of fence with it. And then you got cattle downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And you got everybody mad. Everybody's mad at you because your cattle's eating their flowers and their shrubs. You're mad because usually it's right in harvest season. And you don't have the stock racks on your truck to go get your animals, which you've got to make a sudden shift. But as more homes got up the mountain, believe it or not, it became much better with that. But there still were, there are occasional problems. Well, anyway, out here, the doctor in the corner started changing the locks because somebody would jimmy him up. And of course, you can't patrol things 24 hours a day. People do leave. And so then some of these landowners, and basically, they rarely use these 10-acre plots over here. They're totally timbered. And once in a while, some of them would be logged off or something. But they would get mad, and then the doctor would say, well, I'll give you an extra key. Well, you know what happens with keys. They get lost, and then the locks get changed again. And so there finally is some heated words, and the doctor says, this is my land. It's not a declared road. And you can't threaten me like that, and I'll just close the whole thing off. And that's what he did. And finally, this has nothing whatever to do with it, but it was finally the doctor that defeated me for a school board position. It has nothing to do with the road, because Dad had had divested himself of his interest to his brother and brother-in-law way before that time. But the landowners still had land up there, finally had to go about a mile and a half north and buy a right-of-way up from Hunter to a different direction.
Well, here's a subject related to the east slopes of Mount Emily. Mushrooms.
Don't know anything about them.
Nothing about them. This has been a favorite picking area for years, hasn't it? Morels and brain mushrooms?
I can't tell you.
We used to have morels in our place right out here in the field. And I don't know what happened to them, but we don't have them anymore. We used to mushroom, but we didn't mushroom around here. We always went up to
Ladd Canyon,
Mount Emily Road, up the freeway, and off in there. We haven't mushroomed for a long time.
Haven't mushroomed in 20 years. There are a few huckleberries on the front side on the east side of the.
Well, it was more than 20 years ago that I was wondering about, especially.
I don't know anything about mushrooms.
Is that because you don't like mushrooms?
No, I love them. I know how to stay out of trouble. I know what morels are and what
with poisonous mushrooms?
Yeah. Cauliflower mushrooms and calf's brains and snow mushrooms. Love them. But we haven't mushroomed since the girls were small.
Well, what do you know about the weather conditions here that make this a good place to get mushrooms?
Regarding mushrooms, I don't know. I'm not knowledgeable.
Okay. Why don't we switch over, if you're ready, to the farm viewer experience you had?
Well,
is this a county agency?